Hello, good evening. I'm calling from Arizona, Flagstaff, Arizona. It is late August, August 31st of 2019. My name is Nebojša Borković. I go with the nickname of Neb. I was born and raised in former Yugoslavia, Serbia, Belgrade. And I finished my elementary schooling over there and have immigrated to the United States during the communist regime of Tito in 1973. I lived in Detroit for 2 years, Buffalo, New York for 5 years, and I moved to Phoenix, Arizona, to these parts in 1981. How to start this? As far as UFO phenomena itself, as a young person, I really didn't know what to think of it. I watched a few movies, I looked at some pictures, some grainy pictures of the alleged saucers. There were very few books back then anyway, maybe a dozen or so, that were written in the 60s, 70s. It wasn't a very huge subject. So I really could not bring any kind of educated opinion about it. It was just something that could be out there, maybe not. So maybe it is, maybe it's not. However, I do have one strange experience. From my early days, from childhood, I was about an 8-year-old boy, 1967, in Zadar, city of Zadar, old Italian city Zara, in 1967, which I really can't attribute to any kind of a dream or whatever. It is a very strange experience. I was asleep in a bed with my father, and about 3 or 4 in the morning, I found myself sitting on a bed for no reason. My father was sleeping, there was nobody else in the house, and I'm looking around, and in front of me I see this little personage, even shorter than me, and that was only maybe like 4'5" or so at the age of 8, and this thing was looking at me with some huge black eyes staring at me very intently, and going for some kind of a body gyrations, moving its arms up and down, and I somehow knew I had to follow it, I had to be observant, and next thing I remember, I'm in this closet, and I'm pulling all the clothes on me, I can feel shoes hitting me in the head, pants, shirts, and by that time my father woke up and said, "What are you doing in the closet? What's up? What's going on?" So, "Dad, I'm looking for those eyes." And that's all I remember. I thought it was a dream. So he told me it was a dream, and so I took it to be a dream for many, many years. I had another experience like that, similar experience in Buffalo, New York. In the wintertime after my father's passing, I was asleep, and I woke up paralyzed in my room and knew that this is going inside of a room. It was not a dream, per se. There was somebody standing on the balcony of the old wooden house that we had in Buffalo, New York, in the middle of winter snow. And next thing I knew, it was some claws, two long fingers going through the window, and Venetian blinds, and some yellow, shiny eyes staring at me. And next thing I knew, somebody ran towards my bed, and I freaked out. And by the time I woke up and turned on all the lights in the house, there was nobody there. So those are only two experiences that I had that were kind of anomalous and kind of scary. During the 80s, Niklas Luba's book, Comedian, came out, and I could not finish reading it. I threw it away. I thought the second one, I threw that one away, too. The picture scared me, the story scared me, and I couldn't sleep at night without lights on. I imagine a lot of people have gone through a similar experience. But anyway, all the way through the 80s, and I had a desire to go sailing because my father had a small motorboat back in Adriatic in Zadar in Croatia, and we used to go cruising the islands for sometimes up to a month. So the ocean, the sea, the love of it always stayed within me, and this is something I wanted to pursue in my 30s and 40s, and for the rest of my life, be an adventurous. I was one on a boat. So in 1989, I purchased my first sailboat in San Diego, California, and after a year of preparations, against all the advice from more experienced sailors and all the others from the family, I took it solo to Hawaii, 52-day long voyage, which ended unceremoniously on the beaches of the Big Island, I crashed the boat into the rocks and survived the shipwreck. Of course, that didn't teach me. So I returned to California, and in 1998, I bought my third boat. Second one I had in between, and I just lived on it for a while. Didn't really take it far out. This third one I named Mira after my mother. And in 1987, a year or so before this, I met this individual, a good friend, a Navajo Indian fellow named Donald Begay, who was to accompany me sailing. I told him about the ocean, I told him about how to sail, how to work the boat, how to navigate, and it was great, because after the first solo experience, I did not want to go in the ocean alone again. I wanted some company and some help. So what we did, in the late fall of 1999, we took Mira down along the coast of Baja California on a 47-day long journey to Cabo San Lucas and City of La Paz, which is a major and final destination for a lot of cruisers there before they go further south. You have to do it in between, after the hurricane season, of course. So after 47 days, we made it to La Paz and left the boat there for the winter. We came back to Arizona, both of us. He went home. He's from a little town called La Cachica, Arizona. So in April, we got together back in Phoenix and made it to San Diego. And from there, took a bus to Cabo San Lucas to continue on with the voyage. My initial goal was to go further south, maybe towards Costa Rica, and then to Marquesa Island, maybe to New Zealand, just a daydream. But I knew somehow that it would be a lot cheaper and much more economical and smarter to make the Hawaii again, to repeat the sale that I've done in 1991. So, after some preparations, we got the boat ready and commenced the voyage on April 10th of year 2000. As we left the harbor, first night out, we passed a couple islands, and this is where the first sighting took place. Dan was below in the cabin sleeping, and I was steering the boat. It was about 2 in the morning. Sparsely cloudy night. And I noticed some strange bugs coming out of our edge of this one cloud. Of course, there was no rain. I didn't hear any thunder. It obviously wasn't lightning. And it kept blinking, blink, 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 and it wouldn't leave the cloud. So I just kind of more or less disregarded that. I thought it was a jetliner going to Mazatlan, because there's an airport in La Paz that connects Mazatlan, Acapulco, other parts, Mexico City, to Baja Peninsula. But the light never ever lit the cloud. It just kept blinking there once in a while, and that was it. So I didn't think much of it. In the morning, we were about maybe 20, 30 miles south, going along the eastern part of Baja towards Cabo San Lucas. We were going to stop there before the actual takeoff for Hawaii, for the Big Island. So that morning, we cooked breakfast, and again, I was steering. I look up, and there was this chrome sphere standing over us, very high up. Like a little balloon. So now you imagine the South Baja, there isn't not too many things flying there, no helicopters. You may see an airplane, but by the time you jet contrails, or not very much. That's not a good place for a balloon of any kind. But anyway, there was a chrome sphere that just stood there, and next thing I know, it vanished. I called down to see it, and he couldn't see anything. It was gone already. Broad daylight. So it took another day and a half to circumnavigate the peninsula. We got caught in a terrible storm that night, 40, 50 knot gale. And we decided not to anchor in Cabo San Lucas, but to continue straight to Hawaii, towards Big Island, heading 270 east. The first night, not much happened. We passed a ship, this Mexican Navy ship, and I talked to an American ship, a transport ship named Pecos. They asked him about the weather conditions. He said, everything looks good. You guys can continue, no problems. Second day out, we were already maybe a good 400 miles out, middle of the Pacific. You can't see land anymore. Again, 2 in the morning. Again, the gun was below. I was steering the boat. About 2 in the morning, I look up skyward, and I notice this little green neon lights. It seemed like to be falling from someplace and slowing down. And all of a sudden, it performed this hopping maneuver like a frog. Blink, 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 blink. Let's jump in, jumping around. And I rubbed my eyes and I kept looking. What is this? I mean, I've never seen anything like this. It blinked a couple of times and in nonchalantly flew away. So that was it for that night. The following night, again, about 2 o'clock in the morning, 2:30, I don't exactly have the time. Both of us were in a cockpit this time. Again, the green neon light shows up very high in the sky. It's falling, slowing down, blinking for something, circling around, blinking like it's looking for something. And blink, 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 blink here, and then it would disappear, blink on the other part of the sky, blink, blink, and it stood over us, very high up. And it made this one huge blink, and it made a 360-degree loop, and took off into outer space, leaving a yellow trail behind it. With a small, I think I could hear a pop when it did that. when I seen this, any kind of illusion that we are alone, that there are no UFOs, that this is all the hoax, this is all a fantasy, it just was swept away. I've never seen anything take off at that velocity. That was fantastic. We both were looking at each other and just wondering, oh my God, where are we? Why is this happening? We were heading towards the port of Hilo. That voyage took 35 days. And towards the big island of Hawaii, we had a UFO sighting at least 5-6 other times. Two nights after this particular sighting, we had a red object start approaching the boat, and it stood to the east. It stood it was like a mass or like a little fire, like something extremely red. And I was very afraid. I didn't know what to do. I started blinking lights at it, and nothing. There was no response of any kind. And I got on the radio, VHF radio. I called out, "Who are you? Identify yourself, please. This is a sailing vessel, Mira. Where are you from? Who are you? Tell me something. Where are you?" And the thing slowly faded away, and it vanished, not to be seen again. 2 days later, in broad daylight, about 5-6 in the evening, by this time, I already decided to keep a log, ship logs, and start to take any kind of video that I could. I only had one camera aboard, no still cameras. I had a old RCA camcorder, the type that you put the tape inside, and it flops and closes and it films up. It was very hard to film anything from the deck of a heaving sailboat. Anyway, about 5 in the afternoon or so, it was a beautiful sunset was about ready to happen, and somewhat to the north, there was a bank of advancing clouds, a huge, orangish-grayish bank of clouds. And on top of these clouds, there was a small cloudlet, kind of shaped like a boomerang, the only cloudlet slowly moving along with the clouds against the wind. And out of this little mass come two little lights, first one then a second. They leave the mass, fly around, and they go back into the mass, and then the mass moves away from the advancing cloud front and disappears. So at this time, we're totally, why is this happening to us? There was nobody to contact. We had no telephone. Cell phones were very few in between back then. There was no smartphones. You only had VHF, which has a 35-mile radius of communications. So unless there's a ship 35 miles, you can't hear them, they can't hear you, depending how high you put the antenna on the mast. And we didn't have a very large boat. It was only a 29-footer, good enough for two people. Yeah, it was a 1961 Defender Columbia. Good keel, good heavy keel underneath, a very salty boat. And I made it even more so. Did lots of work. So, The voyage to Hawaii, to the big island, to Hilo, took 35 days. We arrived and pulled in, and by this time I was really amazed with all the sightings. After we cleaned up, took a shower, ate something, and got some our land legs back, poor Donnie was falling all over the place. I'm already a veteran, so I knew what to expect when you arrive to the hard land after a long time. So my first thing was to tell somebody about this. You know, somebody ought to know that there are these things, and my reality was already shaken. Sense of reality was shaken. So the first natural thing, I looked into phone books, and I couldn't find a MUFON or any kind of UFO organization, anybody that would listen to it. So I decided to walk over to the police station. Left the boat anchored in Radio Bay and walked up to the police station and wanted to talk to somebody in charge. I said, what do you want to talk about? I said, well, I'd like to report to UFO, some sighting that we saw from our boat. And they were kind of snickering and looking at me funny. It's like, I'm sorry, nobody can help you here. There's no UFO people here. Why don't you contact the Coast Guard? I said, okay, that's a good idea. So I go back to the Coast Guard station, which is in Radio Bay, too. And I walk into the office the next day, and I ask, who could I talk to about reporting a UFO? I said, they told me that the person at the office told me that ship, the cutter named Kiska, which sails from that area, was not there. It was out of harbor. It will be back within 5 days. And I need to talk to the captain of the ship, and tell him about it. Said, okay, good, I'll come back. So we enjoyed Hilo and ate good and started getting some weight back. And I said, because you lose a lot of weight in the ocean and from all the motion. So finally, Kiska pulled in, and I got to meet the captain. I went aboard. I even videotaped the ship, Captain J. Lopes. And they were interested. They wanted to hear the whole story. They were not like the police. They didn't laugh. They didn't make any kind of smart remarks. They took me to the ship's mast, and two other officers were there with him. I forgot their names. I showed him the videos. He couldn't explain. He couldn't tell me what was in the videos that I took. I didn't know either. You know, I just seen some lights flashing here and there, and so you can see. I'm dancing around. I didn't hear my story. They took my report. And they emailed this report to the Coast Guard group, main command in Honolulu. And that was it. We spent a month and a half on the islands. After a couple of weeks, we left Big Island to Maui, went to Oahu, came back to Maui, and then the last island that we've been onto was Kauai. Spent 2 weeks in the beautiful Hanalei Bay. I talked to a few people. I asked a few people, anybody seen anything? They looked at me funny. Said, how many beers were you drinking and all this funny stuff? So by that time, we decided to return to the United States, to San Francisco, which is another even more of a rigorous voyage, one of the longest voyages a small boat can undertake. You have to climb about 1,100 miles north to catch the Japanese current, Kuroshio current, that takes you towards California or Oregon or British Columbia from Japan. And about there, you cross the shipping lanes also. They go from China or Japan or Korea, again, going to Washington, going to California or Mexico, wherever they're going, or British Columbia. So we left. It was, I believe, late June of 2000. And guess what? The first night out, the UFO happens to be there, flying over us again. This time there were two yellow objects that would appear out of nowhere, fly by each other, sometimes stop in midair, and make little circles around each other, separate, and go back where they came from. And we were totally exasperated by this time. I tried my best to catch any kind of video that I could. On a couple of occasions, I was able to capture an object that came close, stopped, and it just lit up like a huge lantern. It lasted 21 seconds. And what happened with this one is about half an hour before this video, an object appeared. I took my reflector light, half a million candles searchlight, and I pointed exactly towards it. It stopped in its track and disappeared, took off where it came from. Half an hour later it comes, it stops over my boat, and it lights up. It gave me enough time to jump below and get the camcorder ready. So I got about 21 seconds of the video of that particular occurrence. A little later on, some nights later, again, the object shows up, and this time it just blinks out. Fraction of a second. So I captured it on two occasions, the disappearance. Finally, about midway, once we climbed 1,100 miles north and corrected the course to go east towards California, to the patch of no wind, with lots of motoring because it's called Pacific High area, high pressure area. There's not much wind there. Unless you have a motor that can push you through it to about a good 600, 700 miles. See, it expands and contracts depending on the time of year. Lots of garbage right now is circling in that area. It's called the High Pacific Patch. You could be stuck there without an engine. You could be stuck there for months. 2 months. You could never see land. And if you have no food, you're left to yourself. No help. So anyway, we made it through. But one night, we see an object slowly cruising again, very high up, and started descending exactly towards us. What is this, Don? They stood both of us in silence, just staring at this thing. It was a flying horseshoe with four red vivid lights lined up, and there was some kind of navigation lights, green lights on its sides. Silent, and it flew over us, and when it did, behind it, in this allegedly what you would call a tail area, there was a huge yellow squarish light. It was immediately followed by a second object. It followed, again, another horseshoe, but with a different setup of lights, less red lights. Silently, no noise, no jets, no pump trails, nothing. And now you got to imagine that this is enormous Pacific with a blacked-out sailboat at night. Helicopters can't make it that far unless there's a helicopter carrier or aircraft carrier nearby. They all have to come back for gas. Even jetliners, they got to fly to Hawaii, wherever they're going, they don't have time to descend from 50,000 feet of altitude and look for a small sailboat at night. I even talked to an expert about how hard would it be to find a boat at night if you didn't know the position. And he told me, no way. At night, forget it. Without a light or your known position or some kind of report or EPIRB signal, we could not find you. In the best of conditions, a flight, again, Hercules aircraft that can fly from California, it can fly 2,500 miles out, then he has to go back for gas. He only has a limited amount of time to look for you. They can see you maybe for a mile and a half under the best observation circumstances and drop you some help, whatever, a raft or food, whatever you need, if you establish contact. If they didn't know where you are, this is almost impossible for aircraft to find you. So any kind of later observations from those learned people, you skeptics, oh, you just seen the helicopter. Oh, you seen the lights. You seen a Chinese lantern in the middle of the ocean. You seen a jetliner. You seen a satellite. It's absolute bunk. But towards the end of the voyage, about 8 days, and this is the most anomalous event that I really couldn't take it very seriously at the time. I didn't know what to think of it. I thought it was funny. I think it was strange. But it proved to be the pivotal point of my entire case and later observations and later findings that I'm working on even now. My friend, were still in the boat, I went to sleep. We were about 5 days, 5 to 6 or so days. I had everything written in the notes. We took GPS positions, headings, everything's here. Everything in the notes, occurrences, the colors of the object, everything's here. I'm looking at the magazine, at the notebook right now. So he was seeing the boat. I was asleep. And about 5 in the morning, I woke up to take over. I made some coffee. And he was looking at me with very red eyes, very tired. He said he had a headache in 2 spots of his skull. And he said he's seen the object, something to fool over us. I said, well, what else is new? You know, we already know that they're following us. On a couple of occasions, I exchanged light signals with them. I would blink 4 times in my lantern, flashlight, and they would answer. 1, 2, 3, 4. 1, 2, 3, 4. And disappear. So the contact was already established. Very primitive type of contact. So I told him, why don't you go back to sleep? I'll take over, you know, in the morning, wake up and make some coffee, and, you know, and tell me about it later, what you saw. He was very tired, so he went to sleep. I kept steering. It was getting warmer. You start taking your oil skins off, you know, your shirts, and pretty soon you're a tank top and feeling nice and comfortable in the morning. Beautiful ocean around you. So about noon, he wakes up, and I saw him in the cabin sitting in the bunk looking around. He made some coffee. And he informed me, Neb, I had a strange dream. And I asked him, now, what did you dream about? Can you tell me? Okay, hold on, let me make some coffee and I'll tell you. And he tells me that his dream, he's in his hometown of Lukachukai with his brother. Subsequently, he has passed away at age 50. And in his dream, he's in this little hill overlooking Lukachukai, and by his hogan, which is a traditional Navajo home, they see this huge crown-shaped object with lots of lights that flies. He described it as a neon sign that kept changing bulbs and lighting and moving slowly, and he moved over the house into this little crowd and disappeared. And I said, well, this sounds very, very interesting. Before you forget it, could you please do me a favor, since it's kind of a weird dream, and put it down on the paper? Write it down and draw it, and to the best of your ability, the best of your knowledge, memory, before you forget it. And he kind of smiled and said, yeah, I can do it. And within a few minutes, he drew something, and I kept looking at it, and I was kind of amused because what he drew, it was a circle with some lines across it, and there was a central separation area. And he said, there were lights in the center moving kind of like a serpent, kind of like a snake. And I said, well, this is weird, you know. You sure? And he almost drew it automatically, you know, boom, 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 boom. There was no thinking, he just drew it out, you know, like some kind of channeling or something, very strange. And then what amazed me was that I had a similar dream in 1997 before I actually met him. Now, you remember in 1997 there was a huge sighting over Phoenix, famous case, Phoenix Lights, of three enormous craft. One was boomerang, one was a triangle, the other one was a V-shaped object that nobody has explained yet. And but anyway, that happened in May. In March of the year. I met Don, I believe, in May, a month or so after the sightings. I've never had a sighting of those crafts myself. I read about it. I seen something in the paper. It was kind of interesting. But this took place before everything. Anyway, in my dream, the crown that he drew in the paper was vaguely familiar to me. In my nightmare from 1997, I'm sleeping in my room, totally dark, totally quiet. I open my eyes and I can't move. I'm paralyzed. And I sense there's somebody sitting near my bed and looking at me. Just prior to this, I had a dream that the entire sky has exploded with UFOs, balls, rocket saucers, beautiful sky, full objects. And all of them start moving away, and here comes this like a mothership, like a huge crown-shaped object that moved in as they all scattered away. And this is when I woke up. I try to wake up, but I'm paralyzed, total silence in my room, and there's a personage, some kind of a shape, standing on, near my bed. Next thing I know is I see this torso, a shape, a ghostly black shape that moves, points his arm towards the ceiling, and goes through the ceiling, disappears through the ceiling. So that was kind of weird. And I kept looking at his diagram, looking at him, said, this is what you dreamt? I said, yeah, this, me and my brother, we saw this thing in a dream, they're kind of strange, huh? I said, yeah, I'm glad you put it down on the paper. So we finally made San Francisco. I have a date here, and I believe it was August 7th. And this particular dream of his took place on July 26th. The dream that he had. And when he drew the diagram, it was on 27th, July 27th. And he was born on June 27th. So later on, all these numbers, everything became important. But years later. So we made it to San Francisco. We anchored off Richardson Bay, the only free anchorage at that time left in California, because all the boats were being squeezed out, especially in the marina, doing high docking rates, or on a mooring ball, you could only anchor your boat in Richardson Bay. So by this time, we were totally, I decided to contact MUFON, like I decided to contact reporters. This people got to hear about this. Pacific Ocean is full of UFOs. I mean, they're all over the place. So as soon as we recuperated, I got on the phone to the phone booth. Remember, still there was the cell phones were a rare thing back then, in the year 2000. Very few people had them. So there were still some phone booths around. I got into one. I started calling newspapers, San Francisco Examiner, and blah blah blah. Television stations. Everybody laughed at me. They slammed the phone down. Nobody would talk to me. You're crazy? You saw a UFO? Okay. We'll call you back. Give us your number. So I don't have a number. So, well, we'll call you back. So they never did, of course. There's only one paper person answered. So should I slam the phone to this guy or what? No. I talked to him for a second. I heard him talking in the background. And out of this call materialized visit to the reporter, a lady reporter, her name was Jane Futcher, from Marin County, Marin and the Independent Observer, so it was the name of the newspaper. So we made an appointment, and both of us went to the Marin Independent Observer's offices, and we showed them the videos, we talked, we gave them the story. I was really happy about that. By the time she got through to Peter Davenport, sir, so he called me. I called him. We chatted for a while. I gave him the report, and within a few days, I mailed him a copy, a Xerox copy of my notes. So Peter Davenport has them, and the videos, too, later on. And he told me, when you get to Phoenix, you must talk to MUFON there. He gave me a number. The director, state director at that time was Sylvester, a man named Sylvester, and he gave me a number for a video examiner, Tom Kink, who was involved with Phoenix Lights, along with Jim Dottorso. So I was really happy that I made these contacts, and John Futcher told me your interview will come up very soon, and enjoy your stay in San Francisco. So we stayed there two weeks. I left near in the storage in Alameda for 2 years, because later on, after I fixed the boat, after, you know, get my adventure urges again, I was going to take her back to Mexico eventually. So the boat stayed there, and we took a bus to Phoenix. We came to Phoenix, and within a couple of days, we organized a meeting with MUFON crew, the Sylvester sent. No problem. People came and they separated us. Each, both Don and I, we were in separate bedrooms. And we gave our reports. We showed them the videos. And they took the reports and they said, we'll be back to you. And that was it. Within a few days, Don was on a bus back to Ocachico, back to his village, stayed in Phoenix, totally mesmerized, still wondering about this. What should I do with all this? It overtook my life, how important this was. So within about a couple of weeks, I got a call from Don. I said, guess what, Webb? I said, what? I said, I saw the object, and I took a picture of it, exactly where my dream was. What? This is impossible. This can't be true. You're joking. So no, I got a picture. I had a little throwaway Kodak Polaroid, not a Polaroid, but a little Kodak camera, and I took a picture of it. And it's exactly the same location where my dream was. And some members of my family, my mother, my nieces, they all saw it. It stood there broad daylight for 40 minutes. Something metallic in one position, and then it just vanished, disappeared. And I asked him, well, can you send me the picture? I got to see this. I almost disbelieved him. So he made me the picture. I took the picture, and I took the videos from the ocean, made an appointment with Tom King for analysis, and spent some time with King. Very pleasant man. He knew a lot about UFOs. At that time, he was chasing a UFO called Bubba. It was flying around Phoenix area. He would appear and follow airplanes. He even almost caused a collision with a jetliner one time. All of this is totally verifiable on Tom King's YouTube channels. You can watch the videos and his shows even now from that time. So I was very glad to meet him, and he put the picture through a machine to a computer, and there was a little bright white spot, just a whitish, like a tiny little cloud, and other clouds, just sitting there, in the exact location as his dream was. And Tom King's computer, the readings, or the values, they're showing something acorn shape. Sorry, I gotta take a drink here. Which roughly matched Can you stop just for a second?
Okay. Yeah, the tape's almost
there, okay.
Yeah.
Shoot.
And now?
Yeah.
Yes, and Tom King's the video has been analyzed, and at the same time, the story came into the evening news, Fox Evening News, and they interviewed me. They made a nice little 15-minute story, but they showed only one video, and they laughed it off. So some astronomers who saw this particular video said this was just a sighting of Venus. So that made me mad, and I started calling around real scientists, rich astronomers. There was no names. I called Mount Palomar, Mount Wilson in California, Kitt Peak in Tucson. I called ASU, Canadian Royal Astronomical Almanac. I checked at that date when I took this one particular video of a huge object coming going towards a large cloud, going into the cloud, drilling a hole in the cloud, coming back and going back inside. They said it was Venus. And all these professional astronomers told me, no, Venus was behind the sun. It couldn't be seen. Even a blade of grass could obstruct it. And this thing was 15 degrees up, high in the sky. So I used real scientists to make the skeptics and so-called astronomers and news people be total fools in my book. I called Rudy Cerveni. I talked to Stanton Friedman. I've talked to physicists, I've talked to weather people, I've talked to aviation experts, and my videos, one or two of them are totally anomalous. I've sent the videos also to Jeffrey Sani of MUFON, and the video in which the object disappears instantly, which I mentioned before, You said this was anomalous. Nothing could disappear this fast, because at one moment it's there, and the next frame is totally black. It winked out. And the speed of one video frame is 1/30th of a second, and the next frame is gone. So for a number of months, I did not know what we're looking at. Where did it go? Where did this thing go? I blew it up. It cost me $300 out of my own money to take it to this laboratory downtown Phoenix. They blew it up, and it shows a saucer-shaped object. Where did it go? So I took that to a different studio, and I wanted to know what's going on with this black frame, the next frame. Can you please blow it up? And they started blowing and blowing and blowing. In about 11 levels of magnification comes a sort of tiny white spot of exactly 4 pixels. 4 pixels of the same shape as the object before it disappeared. So, at this velocity, we estimated this to be between 3 to 5,000 miles an hour acceleration in 1/30th of a second. A human eye can't follow it. But there are some cannon artillery shell that could leave the barrel at that speed too. So obviously there was nobody shooting off the cannon in the middle of the ocean, high up in the sky. So whatever this technology is, this is millions of years old, and it never changes. This is another one of the later findings that I had as of last year or so about the technology itself. But going back to this object, a month before Jeffrey Sanger said that this is anomalous, I underwent a hypnosis session with Dr. Ruth McKinley Hover, who was a group of John Mack's organization, PEER. She hypnotized me, and in my trance, pretty soon I started losing her voice. At first I didn't think I was going to be hypnotized. I thought this was a joke, you know, this is not going to happen to me. But she hypnotized me. She was very good. I find myself flying outside of my boat, looking at the ocean. And towards me, I see this cloud, and outside of a cloud, there's this tiny flying saucer sticking out, and I'm floating towards it. The next thing I know, I see some green light around me, and I feel some kind of commotion, and I almost had a heart attack. She had to bring me out, and I was screaming in terror. She told me, your mind doesn't want to go there. So, a month later, this video was analyzed and it shows a saucer there. And, believe it or not, I have reports of people from Hawaii seeing a saucer in a cloud before our experiences and a month or so after our experiences. There's a report to a man looking at this flying saucer in the cloud near the Big Island. So that's absolutely amazing. So, anyway, for a number of years, I even met Bud Hopkins one time in San Francisco, one of the big UFO seminars there, which Dr. Wu took me to. She was kind of my mentor, UFO mentor. I decided to write a book, and my book came out in 2002. So for a number of years, I didn't know much about it. You know, I read the books, I met people, I listened to people, I look at shows, I look at documentaries, and all of this was really fascinating, and I kept thinking about this being some kind of extraterrestrial, interstellar origin, some kind of aliens coming to this planet. I didn't know what to think. Along with those strange dreams I had in the past, I listened to people who were allegedly abducted. I even met Travis Walton twice. I gave him my book. He has an amazing case, amazing man. It happened in Arizona in 1975, I believe. And for a number of years, until 2004, I didn't know what to think of this. Where did the UFO go? What does this drawing mean? It was obviously some kind of precognitive dream for the subject to show up exactly as his drawing showed. So, after the release of my book followed, I went for a small speaking tour. I met Stanton, I met Linda, I met all those guys. I met Whitley Strieber, I met Bud Hopkins in San Francisco. He's a great guy. Even Al Dirick, I met him too. The one from the ship. The ship that disappeared. Philadelphia Experiment. Remember that one?
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I met the old Al Dirick. I met Jim Morris. I met a whole bunch over there. A couple of European guys. Never met Ballet. Ballet is my number one guy.
And when did you get the idea about writing the book? Like, how long after?
Within the first year. I mean, I only had enough materials. I've got a whole... This notebook, just in itself, it's a little book, too, you know, that I took. I got the original copy right here with me. I got a bunch of other copies. So that took... I had a friend who was an English teacher. And he helped me along, back then, I was really bad with computers, just started. Barely sent an email. And he showed me how to use words, how to fix the grammar, and he helped me a lot. So he kind of co-wrote the book with me. He was not a UFO believer, so, you know, I believe you, but I don't believe in UFOs. So he helped me write a book, and then it started doing okay. And I couldn't find a publisher, you know, and so I self-published with Ex Libris, but I'm ready now to cut them off and put the book myself on Amazon pretty soon here. And they're totally useless. And what I found out, you know, over time, that the vast majority of UFO people, investigators, scientists, nobody wants to keep in touch. Nobody's interested. Everybody's doing their thing, and so I kind of gave up after a while. After Ruth died, you know, I just kind of put it in the back burner for years. And then I got a call last year when I was just before my trip, before I went to Spain, from, you probably heard of Giuliano Marinkovic, the Croatian guy. Hmm. Yeah, he's from the same town that I left from. I'm Serbian and he's Croatian. He was in the army there. And he heard the story. And he found the book, and first I didn't know who it was, so he kept emailing, who's this guy? You know, I kind of didn't even want to talk to him. Then I realized he's a big reporter there in Europe. He was in shows, in television shows, a number of times, and all over Europe. Now he lives in Ireland right now. So he wants to release the story, too. But again, you know, nobody really wants to get into deep discussions or exchange of information or... Everybody's pushing their thing, you know. Some guys are totally nut and bolt. Other guys are just abductions. Other guys are spirituality or giants or whatnot. But it's all connected. It's all connected. So anyway, I'm just telling you're not recording yet, no.
All right, we can stop. We can stop. But that's pretty well it.
Are we recording now?
We were recording all that, yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Well, anyway, I, in 2004, February 26th, again the 26th, I got invited to talk to a Navajo Community College near Sully, Arizona. It is in a small town of Sully, Arizona, north of Window Rock. And after a speech, my book was already out. I went to the library, and I did not even know what I was looking for. I was just going through some ancient things. They had a lot of manuscripts and books and paintings and drawings and whatnot, museum pieces there from different various tribes. And I picked up one book by Polly Shazma, Native American Anasazi expert when it comes to petroglyphs and pictograms and stuff like that, college professor. And I saw her book, and it said Pueblo Shields, and it shows shields with two little critters flying around, look like typical aliens. They said they could fly in the sky, cause rain, and take off and whatnot. And right next to her big book, there's a little tiny book called Pueblo Shields. And I picked that book, and about on page 8, my jaw just drops. The design that Don drew is almost identical to the drawing of an ancient shield on the page 8 of this book. So at this time my mind stops, and I didn't know what to do with this. So I started studying all this, and I found, I started to suspect he had the same number of lines, he had 5 lines across, and altogether he had 142 dots. And Diamond Design had 81 dots, and 32 dots, it was split up, see, it was a bottom design and a side design. It looked like a crown. The crown design had 32 dots and 9 separations. The bottom part, which again was split in two, had altogether 81 dots. So I started counting all these dots and lines, and I started putting in the computer, and the shield design had 142 dots. So I put that in the computer to see what would come up, and the first thing that comes up was an allusion to a biblical Psalm 142. And I'm not a religious person at all. I don't read a Bible or study that or anything, but I look into it, and it talks about Saul that's imprisoned in Iraq in a cave, and one day will be released. The righteous will get to know him. His enemies are bigger, stronger than him, and blah, 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 whatnot. So I didn't think much of it. Then I kept studying it, and I find that Don's dots are 145. Next thing that comes up is Saros, which is an ancient Babylonian cycle of eclipses. Everybody uses Saros cycle. There are 42 cycles all around. Partial eclipses, full eclipses, and then closing eclipses. One cycle can last 1,500 years, 1,200 years, depending on which. So, Saros 145, first eclipse, original eclipse, took place in 1639. Mm. And the shields were discovered in 1926 in Utah by a Mormon man named Pechtold. And they were fought over. Every tribe wanted to have their shields, including the one with dots, buffalo hide shields. Every tribe fought over it, but nobody could prove the ownership for many, many years. The guy even had a possession of them near the Kepler Reef monument in Utah. So in 1926, they were found. And Don's design has 26 dots in the middle, and 19 on the bottom, and I believe 36 on the top. So 81 altogether. It's 1926. Hmm. And the buffalo hide shield was a little tiny speck was taken to UCLA for carbon 14 testing, and it shows the year the buffalo was born around 1640, circa 1640, exactly as the Saros 145, which also happens to be show up in England as enormous Saros 145 crop circle. Just showed up one morning. So whoever designed this and gave it to Don was highly intelligent. So for a number of years, I've been studying these designs. I'm finding similarities, synchronicities with other work, and connecting the entire phenomena. Until 2009, I had another sighting in Arizona on an enormous boomerang with another friend. I have a video which is still being worked on. I sent it to Sweden for analysis. I didn't hear anything yet. But this thing was enormous, a mile wide, and it showed up over the town of Y, south of Ajo, Arizona. I have a 10-minute video of the subject flying over a store. And 2 F-16s were vector to check it out, and they nonchalantly flew away from it, didn't want to mess with it. Hmm. And there are some other things about this particular video that confirmed all of this. Ever since all these events, I've been traveling internationally. I've been to Ecuador, I've been to Peru, I've been studying Paracas skulls, and there's a connection green diagram to the heads, the mysterious heads, elongated heads, at least a couple of them, from Paracas, Peru. It's an amazing culture down there. And I'm finding certain American values appearing all over the world, in ancient architecture, in the hymns of people, in the stories from all over the world. So what can be deduced about this phenomena, I think, at this point, and I think even Jacques Vallée would agree with me, that we're not dealing with some interstellar invaders. We're not dealing with interstellar travelers that are coming here to check on us, especially from 1947, after the blast of atomic bombs that Stanton Friedman liked to mention. This is something ancient. This phenomenon, this technology, wherever it is, has already been established in the very beginning of humankind. It goes back to at least 300,000 years B.C. Every human religion, every human culture is based on this. Every human writing, symbolism, everything is based on this. And this exists in some kind of a different dimension in which the dead go and in which the dead return to the world of living. And these guys, whoever they are, have found a way to get into this dimension and live there. Because what is most intriguing about this, you can see the sightings and descriptions of the objects and what they do. They pretty much do the same thing. Land, take off, appear, show up, take people, and they all look alike. Saucers, bowls, triangles, cigars, they never change. There's no innovation. And what does that tell you? When there's no innovation, wherever they are, there's no time. There's no need for innovation because technology is already superb, and no need for it to change or progress. And they disappear, they can be translucent, they can leave marks on the ground, they can take people, they can direct your life as a book. Your entire life path could be programmed from them. There are even some religions that talk about that. For example, I find the strangest thing, philtrum, the nose dip under your nose. In ancient Jewish religion, it is the angel that puts his finger on the baby's mouth and tells the baby to be quiet and not to remember what happened before during her other life, before she was born or he was born. So that's a legend, Jewish legend of the philtrum. So you will find these things, and they all connect. And I have a bunch of evidence here that I'm still working on. I'll be working on my new book, hopefully starting this year. It could be a 400 or 500 page book. It might take me a couple of years to get done. But if that's the last thing I do in my life, this is what it will be. Because I think it's amazing, and I think we're making progress. And it's amazing that what's going on now with the Nimitz sightings, and it's all coming out. With Admiral Wilson's story, the government know about it. The U.S. government surely knows about it. Hundreds of pilots, military, civilian, have seen this. Astronauts, cosmonauts, astronomers, scientists, investigators of every stripe and kind. But it's paraphysical. This is why it's so hard to describe it. Part of it is neither here nor there, as one would say. Part of it is physical, other parts is anecdotal. And this is what makes it so unbelievable to people and so difficult to track. But if you take mathematics and the American values in which they appear and that they use, you will see how consistent this is and how real this is. And I have discovered, my friends, I have discovered the meat, the connective tissue between the sightings and the phenomena itself and the ancient sightings and everything around us. So at this point, I think I could cut it off and leave it at that. And you can see the picture. You can see one video that I sent to Michelle. How real this is. Any questions? I'll be available for answers. Thank you.